The tolerant cell. The self, horror autotoxicus, and immunotherapy. And what I assume, you shall assume. For every atom belonging to me, as good belongs to you. Walt Whitman, Song of Myself, 1892. It is time to return to the question, what is the self? An organism, as I suggested before, is a cooperative union of units, a parliament of cells. But where does the union begin and end? What if a foreign cell tried to join the union? What passport must it carry that enables it to pass? As the caterpillar in Alice in Wonderland asked Alice, "Who are you?" Sponges on the ocean floor extend their branches out toward one another, but the branches stop growing once a sponge reaches close to a neighbor. As one spongiologist described it, a clear non-confluent margin separates different species or even different specimens belonging to the same species. What stops cells from transiting between one sponge and another, or from one human to another? How does one sponge know itself? There is a related question implicit in the last chapter that must be answered. T cells, I wrote, recognize the altered self, but if you parse that phrase carefully, it turns into a clown car of questions. All sorts of conundrums come tumbling out the doors. Break the phrase into two parts. First, how does a T cell know its altered self? In other words, how does it know to kill its target when a viral or bacterial peptide is presented, but not when a self-peptide is presented to it? The cell doesn't maintain a ledger of every overlapping self-peptide. The number of all possible peptides in a cell would extend to more than hundreds of millions. And so, what mechanism exists to ensure that a T cell does not attack its own body? And second, what about the self? How does a T cell know that the frame carrying the peptide, the MHC molecule, came from its own body and not from another? Take the question of self first. At first glance, it seems like a rather artificial problem. Humans hardly need to worry about cells from other humans invading and colonizing our bodies and trying to pass themselves off as selves, even though that fantasy continues to inspire horror films and books. But for more primitive multicellular organisms, sponges, say, for which competitive existence is an everyday battle, every morsel of food precious, constancy a looming threat, and territory a limited resource, the potential invasion by another self isn't a trifling matter. Such an organism must query, where do I end and you begin? Itself can exist only if its borders are strictly enforced. Such an organism must constantly ask each of its cells, who are you? Long before the birth of cell biology, Aristotle imagined the self as the core of being, a unity of the body and the soul. The physical boundary of the self, he proposed, was defined by the body and its anatomy. But the totality of the self was a unity of that physical vessel with a metaphysical entity that occupied it, the body filled by the soul. In principle, Aristotle, too, might have fretted about the possible invasion of the physical vessel by a foreign soul. Indeed, possession was frequently used by psychics to explain mental and behavioral breakdowns, but he didn't seem to sweat the question. Once the physical vessel had been occupied by one soul, its potential invasion by or fusion with another soul didn't bother him. In quite the opposite sense, some Vedic philosophers in India, writing between the 5th and 2nd century BC, welcomed the erasure of the individual self and its fusion with the universal. They rejected the Greek dualism between the body and the soul, and indeed between an individual body and the cosmic soul. They termed the self Atman. There are many other Sanskrit words for the self besides Atman, but it is the one that holds the most meaning. The universal, multitudinous self, in contrast, was the Brahman. For these philosophers, the self was an ideal fusion of Atman and Brahman, or, perhaps more accurately, the seamless flow of the universal self through the individual self. However, this fusion flow was reserved as a goal for spiritual attainment. There was a cosmic ecology that bound the individual and the spiritual collective into one being. The phrase tat tvanasi, that you are, permeates the Upanishads and is an expression of the boundless self that permeates not just a single physical body, but also the cosmos. You, the self, the Upanishads proclaim, is permeated and penetrated by that, the universal. In an ideal body, the universal flows through the individual. The word invades, with its negative connotations, is obviously avoided. In science, this boundlessness of the individual body and the cosmic body has more recently found its echo in ecology. The whole ecosystem of living beings, we might say, is connected through a network of relationships and, to some extent, the erasure of the boundaried self. A human body and a tree and the bird that dwells in that tree, say, are linked through such networks, networks that ecologists are just beginning to decipher. The bird eats the fruit from a tree and disseminates the seeds through its droppings. The tree, reciprocally, provides a perch for that bird. It's not invasion, the ecologists insist. It's interconnectedness. But ecological interconnectedness is not physical or competitive. It is relational and symbiotic, a topic to which we will return. For cell biologists, though, it is physical fusion that continues to raise a fundamental conundrum. The notion of chimerism, the fusion of physical cells, is not a New Age fantasy but an age-old threat. Cellular selves don't particularly like to mix with other cellular selves. Why else would a sponge go to such lengths to limit its fusion with another sponge to form a blissfully boundless cosmic Brahman sponge? Extend the same challenge to a T-cell. A T-cell, remember, is activated when a foreign peptide is presented on an MHC protein mounted on a cell surface, but only if it is presented by an MHC that is from the same body. It is as if the T-cell is activated only if the frame, or context, is right. Right in the sense that the frame comes from the self and what is carried is foreign. But how does a T-cell know the self? Even early physiologists noted that the rejection of the non-self and the strict definition of boundaries was a feature of human tissues. Surgeons in India, particularly Sushruta, who lived sometime between 800 and 600 BC, had performed grafts of skin from the forehead to the nose. This was a not uncommon procedure in ancient India, for criminals and dissenters often had their noses chopped off as punishment, leaving medical practitioners to devise ways to reconstruct them. But when early surgeons tried allografts, skin grafts from one body to another, they found that the recipient's immune system set upon and rejected the transplanted skin, causing it to turn blue and gangrenous and eventually degenerate and die. During World War II, there was renewed interest in understanding the underlying science of grafting. Skin grafting, in particular, was of great need, as both soldiers and civilians were often wounded, burned, or scalded by bombs and fires. The British government appointed a War Wounds Committee within the Medical Research Council to encourage research on wounds and healing. In 1942, a 22-year-old woman was admitted to the Glasgow Royal Infirmary with extensive burns on her chest, right flank, and right arm. The surgeon, Thomas Gibson, worked with a zoologist from Oxford, Peter Medawar, to graft small pieces of her brother's skin onto her wounds. Unfortunately, the transplanted tissue was swiftly rejected, leaving trails of charred and mottled tissue on the woman's wounds. When they tried again, the rejection was even more immediate. By studying serial biopsies of the grafts and examining the infiltrating cells, Medawar and Gibson began to decipher that it was the immune system, the T-cell in particular, that was rejecting the graft. The non-self, Medawar argued, was recognized by the self's immunity mediated by T-cells. Medawar knew of the work of a British immunologist named Peter Gorer and of American geneticist Clarence Cook Little, who, working independently, had transplanted tissues from one mouse to another. If the donor and the recipient mice came from the same strain, the transplanted tissues, typically tumors, would be accepted and would grow. but when the tumors were moved from one strain to a different strain, they would be immunologically rejected. Little's interest in genetic purity seemed, at times, all-consuming and obsessive. He produced strains of inbred mice for transplantation experiments, key to the field of T-cell tolerance. He tried to breed dogs for experiments and maintained a personal collection of inbred dachshunds as pets, but the same instincts, perhaps, made him an ardent advocate of American eugenics, which sullied his reputation as a scientist. Albeit a giant in the field of transplantation, Little would also be criticized for his collusion with cigarette manufacturers in the 1950s when he became involved in the Tobacco Research Institute, which insisted on the safety of cigarettes. But what factors were responsible for this compatibility or tolerance, the recognition of the self versus the non-self? In 1929, searching for a contemplative place, far from the dissonance of university departments where arguments about compatibility and tumor transplantation broke out weekly, Clarence Little set up the Jackson Laboratory on a 40-acre campus by the Atlantic Ocean in Bar Harbor, Maine. There he could breed thousands of mice in peace. The view from the windows was spectacular. The long summers suffused the campus with a preternaturally lucid North Atlantic light. The field of transplantation, in contrast, remained a mess, an impenetrable biological puzzle with hundreds of accreted, entangled observations. It made very little sense to Little. By serially transplanting tumors across strains, Little realized that not one, but multiple genes were involved in the immune rejection of the transplant. By the early 1930s, the Jackson Lab had become a natural haven for transplantation researchers hunting for the mysterious compatibility genes that define self versus non-self. A young scientist, George Snell, was drawn to the lab to deepen Little's transplantation studies. A graduate of Dartmouth College and Harvard University, Snell bred mice, generation upon generation, to produce animals that would accept or reject grafts from each other. He was a man of few words, reclusive, as cool as ocean water, and doggedly persistent. Once, when an entire colony of mice, bred for at least 14 generations, died in a laboratory fire, Snell dusted off his overalls and started breeding them again. The selective breeding, while monitoring self versus non-self tolerance, paid off. Immunologically speaking, Snell eventually created multiple twin selves, mice whose tissues were perfectly compatible with each other. You could put the skin, or another tissue from one such mouse, into its compatible sibling, and it would be accepted, tolerated, as if it were from the self. Most crucially, the inbreeding experiment produced two strains of mice that were almost exactly genetically identical, except that they rejected grafts from each other. Snell used these animals to dissect the genetics of self versus non-self. By the late 1930s, building on Gorer's work, he slowly narrowed in on a set of genes that determine tolerance. He termed them H-genes for histocompatibility genes, histo from tissue and compatibility because of their capacity to render foreign tissue to be accepted as self. It was some version of these H-genes, Snell realized, that defines the boundary of the immunological self. If organisms shared the H-genes, you could transplant tissue from one organism to another. If they didn't, the transplant would be rejected. Over the next decades, more histocompatibility genes were identified in mice, all located cheek by jowl on chromosome 17. In humans, they are mostly found on chromosome 6. Perhaps the most profound advance in the field occurred when the identity of these H genes was finally revealed. Most of them turned out to encode functional MHC molecules, the very molecules, recall, that had been implicated in how a T-cell recognizes its target. Step back for a minute. In immunology, as with any science, there are moments of grand synthesis when seemingly disparate observations and seemingly inexplicable phenomena converge on a single mechanistic answer. How does the self know itself? Because every cell in your body expresses a set of histocompatibility, H2, proteins that are different from the proteins expressed by a stranger's cells. When a stranger's skin, or bone marrow is implanted into your body, your T cells recognize these MHC proteins as foreign, non-self, and reject the invading cells. What are these self versus non-self genes that encode the proteins? Well, they are the very genes that Snell and Gore had found and called H2. Humans have multiple classical major histocompatibility genes, and potentially many others, of which at least three, and possibly more, are strongly related to graft compatibility versus rejection. One gene, called HLA-A, has more than 1,000 variants, some common and some very rare. You inherit one such variant from your mother and one from your father. A second such gene, HLA-B, also has thousands of variants. You might have guessed already that the number of permutations between just two such highly variable genes is mind-boggling. The chances that you'd share such a barcode with a random stranger you met in a bar are vanishingly small, and all the more reason not to fuse with him or her. And what do these proteins do when they aren't rejecting grafts and cells from strangers? Obviously an artificial phenomenon, at least in humans, but not perhaps in sponges or other organisms. As Alan Townsend and others had shown, their main job is to enable the immune response to survey cells for their inner components and thereby detect viral infections. In short, H2, or HLA molecules, serve two linked purposes. They present peptides to a T cell so that a T cell can detect infections and other invaders and mount an immune response. And they are also the determinants by which one person's cells are distinguished from another person's cells, thereby defining the boundaries of an organism. Graft rejection, likely important for primitive organisms, and invader recognition, important for complex multicellular organisms, are thus combined into a single system. Both functions repose in the T cell's capacity to recognize the MHC peptide complex, or the altered self. Let's turn now to the other half of the conundrum, the question of the slightly altered self. The T cell, as I mentioned before, uses the MHC molecules to recognize the self and reject the non-self. But how does it discern whether the peptide being presented by the self MHC comes from a normal cell, in other words, it's part of the cell's normal roster of peptides, or whether it comes from a foreign invader, such as an internally dwelling virus that has entered a cell and gone native? I've written so much about war. Kampf, the toxic attacks on pathogens, the rejection of grafts. What about peace, then? Why don't immune cells, loaded with toxins and straining for vengeance, turn against ourselves? This phenomenon of self-tolerance equally puzzled immunologists. In the early 1940s in Madison, Wisconsin, Ray Owen, a geneticist and the son of a dairy farmer, performed an experiment that was, in a sense, the conceptual opposite of Peter Medawar's. In Medawar's test, he had tried to understand the phenomenon of rejection, or the intolerance for the non-self. Why does a sister's immune system reject her brother's skin? Owen inverted the question. Why doesn't a T cell turn against its own body? How does it acquire tolerance for the self? Cows, Owen knew from his farmhand days, were known to occasionally give birth to twins sired by two different bulls. A Guernsey cow might bear a twin fathered by a Guernsey bull and a Hereford bull because they happened to have fertilized the cow during the same fecund period. The twins born from a Guernsey-Hereford fertilization share a placenta, but they had different red blood cells carrying different antigens. Typically, a non-twinned Guernsey cow would reject blood from a Hereford. But in the rare placenta-sharing twins, Owen found that there was no such rejection. It was as if something in the placenta had educated the immune system of one animal to become tolerized to the cells of the other animal. Owen's idea was largely ignored, but in the 1960s, as immunologists began to take tolerization seriously, they returned to his result. Something about embryonic exposure to an antigen must tolerize the immune system to recognize it as self and not attack a cell presenting it. In a 1969 book titled Self and Not Self, McFarlane Burnett, by then already awarded the Nobel Prize for his clonal theory of antibodies, advanced Owen's observations with a radical theory. Recognition that an antigenic determinant is foreign requires that it shall not have been present in the body during embryonic life, Burnett wrote, acknowledging Owen's earlier experiments. The basis for this tolerance was that T cells that reacted against self cells, immune cells that attacked our own, for example, pieces of proteins derived from our own cells and presented on our own MHC molecules, were somehow deleted or removed from the immune system during infanthood or prenatal development. Immunologists called the self-reactive cells forbidden clones, forbidden because they had dared to react to some aspect of a self-peptide and were therefore deleted from existence before they could be allowed to mature and attack the self. Burnett likened them to holes in immune reactivity. It is one of the philosophical enigmas of immunity that the self exists largely in the negative, as holes in the recognition of the foreign. The self is defined in part by what is forbidden to attack it. Biologically speaking, the self is demarcated not by what is asserted, but by what is invisible. It is what the immune system cannot see. Tat tvamasi, that is, what you are. But where were these forbidden holes generated? How do immune cells, such as T cells, make a hole in their repertoire of recognition that does not attack a self protein, say the antigens on the surface of a red blood cell or a kidney cell, as foreign? A series of experiments provided an answer. As Jacques Miller had shown, T cells are born in the bone marrow as immature cells and migrate to the thymus to mature. Philip Amerik and John Kapler, an immunologist couple in Colorado, forcibly expressed a foreign protein in mouse cells, including the cells of the thymus. Normally, such a protein should be recognized and rejected by T cells, but much as Burnett had predicted, they found that the immature T cells that recognized pieces of that protein, the ones that attacked the self, were deleted in the thymus by way of a process called negative selection. The deleted T cells never matured. They left the holes that Burnett had proposed in self-reactive T cells. But T cell deletion in the thymus, a mechanism called central tolerance because it affects all T cells during their central maturation, isn't enough to guarantee that immune cells don't end up attacking the self. Beyond central tolerance, there is a phenomenon called peripheral tolerance. Here, tolerance is induced once the T cells have left the thymus. One of these mechanisms involves a strange and mysterious cell called the T regulatory cell, Treg. It looks almost identical to a T cell, except that rather than incite an immune response, the Treg suppresses it. T regulatory cells zero in on sites of inflammation and secrete soluble factors, anti-inflammatory messengers that dampen the activity of T cells. The most profound evidence of their activity is the disease that occurs when they go missing. In humans, a rare mutation disrupts the formation of these cells and results in a terrifyingly progressive autoimmune disorder in which T cells attack the skin, pancreas, thyroid, and intestines. Children affected by immune dysregulation, polyendocrinopathy, enteropathy, X-linked, IPEX syndrome, suffer intractable diarrhea, diabetes, and psoriatic, friable, peeling skin. They are under attack by themselves because T cells that control other T cells, the policemen who police the police, are missing in action. It is an unsolved quirk of the immune system that the cell type that confers active immunity and incites inflammation, the T cell, and the cell type that dampens these processes, the regulatory T cell, arise from the same parent cells, T cell precursors in the bone marrow. Indeed, aside from very subtle distinctions in genetic markers, T cells and Treg cells are anatomically indistinguishable, and yet they are functionally complementary. Immunity and its opposite are twinned, the Cain of inflammation conjoined with the Abel of tolerance. Sometime in the future, we will understand why evolution chose to pair these cells, but the regulatory T cell remains a mystery, a cell that looks like it might activate immunity, but actually suppresses it. But there are mountains beyond mountains, the Haitian proverb runs. An out-of-control T cell can be so toxic to the body that there are backup systems beyond backup systems. What happens when the major regulatory forces no longer keep the immune system from attacking its own body? Around the turn of the 20th century, Paul Ehrlich, the eminent biochemist, called it horror autotoxicus, the body poisoning itself. The condition befits the name. Autoimmunity ranges from mild to absolutely furious. In alopecia areata, an autoimmune disease, T-cells are thought to attack hair follicle cells. One patient might notice only a single bald spot, while in someone else, the T-cells might assail every hair follicle, resulting in complete baldness. In 2004, when I was a fellow in medicine, I volunteered as an assistant in a graduate course in clinical immunology. My job was to scour the hospital for patients with autoimmune diseases and, with their consent, discuss the physical manifestations, cause, and treatment with the graduate students. My only quibble with Ehrlich's vivid phrase is the singular. Horror autotoxicus, autoimmunity, comes in so many manifestations and forms that there is not a single horror, but rather a multitude. We met a 30-something woman with scleroderma, in which the immune system attacks the skin and connective tissue. In her case, the illness had begun, as it often does, with a phenomenon called Raynaud's disease, in which the fingers and toes turn blue when exposed to the cold. And then, she told the students, my fingers began to get blue when I got emotionally stressed or tired, even without the cold. My mind returned to an image from Shakespeare's poem about winter from his play Love's Labour's Lost. Dick the shepherd blows his nail as the wind howls around him. But this patient's coldness was internal, caused by spasming blood vessels in the hands and feet. It was as if autoimmunity had created an inner freeze. Stranger attacks fell upon the woman's body. Patches of skin began to tighten around her as the immune system turned against her connective tissue. The patches turned shiny, as if pulled by some invisible force, and stretched across her bones. Her lips tightened and scarred. She was treated with immunosuppressants and, to reduce inflammation, corticosteroids, which made her manic. It felt as if my own skin had started to bind me up, like a saran wrap folded around my body. Next was a man with systemic lupus erythematosus, SLE, often referred to simply as lupus. The illness is named after a wolf, either because Roman physicians thought that the skin lesions of this form of horror autotoxicus reminded them of wolf bites, or, more likely, because the rash that spreads across the face, crossing the bridge of the nose and under the eyes, was reminiscent of a wolf's markings. Add to this the fact that sunlight could exacerbate the rash, often forcing lupus sufferers to live in the dark, coming out only in moonlight, and the sinister-sounding name stuck. The hospital room shades had been drawn, letting in only a single shaft of angled light. We gathered around him as if in some sort of sepulchral chamber. The man had a mild rash. He had taken to wearing sunglasses to hide it, but his kidneys were also under attack. Excruciating, wandering pains migrated through his joints, from his elbows to his knees. Lupus is a slippery, motile disease. It might affect just one organ system, such as the skin or the kidneys, or it might suddenly go after multiple systems at once. This patient had volunteered to participate in a clinical trial of a new immunosuppressant, and it seemed to have abated the disease somewhat. What precisely the immune system is reacting against in lupus remains a mystery, but it often involves antigens in the nucleus of the cell, antigens on cell membranes, and antigens on proteins bound to DNA. And sometimes the list of organs being assaulted keeps increasing. The illness moves from joints to kidneys to skin. It's like a fire feeding on itself. Once the barrier to the self has been broken, everything that is self can be under attack. The horror of autotoxicus had a profound scientific lesson buried within it, although it would take decades for immunologists to come to terms with it. Autoimmunity, the attack on self-cells, generated an obvious question. What if the immunological toxicity could be turned on cancer cells? After all, malignant cells occupy the disturbing boundary of the self and the non-self. They are derived from normal cells and share many features of normality. But they are also malignant invaders. Rhinoceroses in one perception and unicorns in another. In the 1890s, a New York surgeon, William Coley, had tried to treat cancer patients with a concoction made from bacterial cells that came to be known as Coley's toxins. His hope was to elicit a powerful immune response that might turn on the tumor. But the reactions were unpredictable. And with the development of cell-killing chemotherapies in the 1950s, the idea of an immune attack on cancer fell out of fashion. But as cancer after cancer relapsed following standard chemotherapy, the notion of immunotherapy was brought back to life. Recall for a moment the mechanisms that allow the body not to be eaten alive by its own T cells. There are forbidden clones that would otherwise react against normal tissues that are forced to disappear during the maturation of T cells, and there are regulatory T cells that can dampen the immune response. In the 1970s, scientists discovered yet other mechanisms by which T cells can be tolerized to the body so that it did not attack the self. To kill its target, for instance, a virus-infected cell or a cancer cell, merely engaging the T cell receptor with the MHC peptide complex was not sufficient. Other proteins on the surface of T cells had to also be activated to stimulate an immune attack. There was not one switch, but a multitude of them. These backups beyond backups, mountains beyond mountains, are like trigger locks and safety switches in guns, and they had evolved to ensure that T cells did not accidentally direct their friendly fire on normal cells. The trigger locks would act as checkpoints against the indiscriminate killing of our own cells. But before understanding and disabling such trigger locks, there was the looming uncertainty of specificity. Could a human T cell response be directed against cancer? At the National Cancer Institute in Bethesda, Maryland, a surgical oncologist named Steven Rosenberg had drawn native T cells out of malignant tumors, such as melanomas, reasoning that immune cells that had infiltrated a tumor must have the capacity to recognize and attack the tumor. Rosenberg's team had grown these tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes, expanding their numbers to several million, and then infused them back into patients. There had been some potent responses. Melanoma patients treated with Rosenberg's transfer T cells saw their tumors shrink, and some experienced a complete regression that was maintained over time. But the responses were also hit or miss. The T cells harvested from a patient's tumor may have trained themselves to fight it, but they might also be bystanders, passive witnesses lingering at a crime scene. They might have become exhausted or inured, tolerized to the tumor. Cancers, varied as they are, share some common features. Among them, their invisibility to the immune system. In principle, T cells can be potent immunological weapons against tumors. As Clarence Little and Peter Gore had shown as early as the 1930s, when a tumor is implanted onto genetically mismatched mice, T cells from the recipient mouse reject the tumor as foreign. But the tumor/recipient systems that Little and Gore had chosen were grossly mismatched. The tumor brandished on its surface an MHC molecule that could instantly be recognized as foreign and thus swiftly rejected. More recently, in Emily Whitehead's case, her CAR T cells had been specifically modified to recognize a protein on the surface of her leukemia cells. Most human cancers, though, represent a vastly more subtle challenge for the immune system. Harold Varmus, the Nobel-winning cancer biologist, called cancer a distorted version of our normal cells. And so they are. The proteins that cancer cells make are, with a few exceptions, the same ones made by normal cells, except cancer cells distort the function of these proteins and hijack the cells toward malignant growth. Cancer, in short, may be a rogue self, but it is indubitably a self. And second, the cancer cells that ultimately form a clinically relevant illness in a human arise through an evolutionary process. The cells that are left after their cycles of selection may have already become capable of evading immunity, like Sam P's immune cells that had, for years, simply brushed past his tumor, ignored it, and moved on. This double-headed problem, cancer's kinship to the self and its immunological invisibility, is the oncologist's nemesis. To attack a cancer immunologically, one has to first make it revisible, to coin a word, to the immune system. And second, the immune system must find some distinct determinant in the cancer that can enable an attack without concomitantly destroying the normal cell. There is a third and increasingly important arena of investigation that concerns cancer's ability to resist destruction by drugs and by natural mechanisms in the body. Cancer cells evolve to create unique cellular environments around themselves, typically by surrounding themselves with normal cells that cannot be penetrated by drugs or that can actively cause drug resistance. Similarly, these cellular environments can evade immunity by rendering T cells, NK cells, and other immune cells inactive, by preventing them from even entering the vicinity of the cancer cell, or by drawing out blood vessels to supply the malignant cells with nutrients. Trials to choke cancer's blood supply, using a variety of drugs, have yielded only modest successes, and so have trials to force immune cells to remain active in cancer's microenvironment. One of the most terrifying scientific images that I've seen in recent times is a tumor surrounded by a shell of normal cells that has excluded activated T cells. The T cells form a ring around the cellular carapace that the cancer has formed around itself, but are unable to penetrate it. The immunologist Ruslan Medjitov has called this the client cell hypothesis. Cancer cells pretend, or more accurately, evolve, to resemble client cells of the organ that they grow in, just like a burglar might pretend to be a client of the shop being robbed while the police, the immune system in this case, look elsewhere. Steve Rosenberg's experiment was an early, flickering sign that both these challenges could be overcome. In a few cases, tumors could become immunologically detectable, and they could be killed by T cells. But what exactly were cancer cells doing to achieve invisibility? Might the cells be using the same mechanisms that the normal body uses to prevent attacks on itself? That is, activating the trigger lock systems that prevent autoimmunity? In the winter of 1994, Jim Allison, working at the University of California, Berkeley, set up an experiment that would revive the field of immunotherapy, in part by unlocking the mechanisms that keep T cells in check. An immunologist by training, Allison had been studying a protein called CTLA-4 that sat on the surface of T cells. The protein had been known since the 1980s, but its function remained a puzzle. Allison implanted mice with tumors that were well known to be resistant to an immune response. The tumors grew obdurately as expected, shrugging off any immune rejection. Experiments by the immunologists Tack Mack and Arlene Sharp in the 1990s had hinted that CTLA-4 might be one of the trigger locks used to keep activated T cells in check. When they had deleted the gene in mice, T cells had run amok and the animals had developed deadly autoimmune diseases. Allison reconceived the experiment, but with a twist. Rather than delete the CTLA-4 gene entirely, might a drug-induced blockade of CTLA-4 unleash T cells against cancer? Allison injected some of the mice with antibodies to block CTLA-4, in essence, blocking the protein's function. Over the next few days, the immune-resistant tumors in the mice injected with the CTLA-4 blockers disappeared. He repeated the experiment over Christmas. Again, the malignancies in the mice injected with the CTLA-4 blocker dissolved, eaten alive, he would later discover, by an infiltrate of Tetchy-activated T cells. Intrigued by this activation of T cells against a tumor, Allison and several other researchers spent more than a decade trying to deepen their understanding of the protein's function. As all the earlier experiments had shown, they found that CTLA-4 was a system to prevent horror autotoxicus. It was a T-cell's trigger lock. Under normal circumstances, when CTLA-4 on activated T-cells meets its cognate binder, called B7, that is present on the surface of cells of the lymph nodes where T-cells mature, the safety switch is turned on. I've tried to avoid an enormous amount of immunological jargon here. B7 is actually a complex of two molecules, CD80 and CD86, And there are yet other backup systems to prevent the T cell from becoming inappropriately activated. One such protein, CD28, initially discovered by immunologist Craig Thompson, is also the subject of intense investigation in my lab and others. The maturing T cells are disabled from attacking the self, but also unable to reject tumors. If you blocked this disabling pathway, however, the safety lock was switched off and you overrode tolerance. CTLA-4 stood as a barrier between inactivated and activated T cells. It was termed a checkpoint, based on the idea that the protein held T cell activation in check. Over time, researchers have discovered that T cells have multiple checkpoints. Each acts as a safety switch to prevent trigger-happy T cells from attacking the self. I'm writing this story as if all of these crucial realizations happened in minutes, but it took decades of labor and love. I met Allison in New York a few years ago, and we spoke about the torturous scientific path to uncovering the function of CTLA-4. He laughed jovially, as if the 10 grinding years that he had spent on the project were merely a distant memory. "No one believed me," he said. "No one thought that there was yet another way to keep T cells in check against cancer cells, but we kept at the problem until we had solved it." While Allison was uncovering the function of CTLA-4, a Japanese scientist named Tasuko Hanjo, working in Kyoto, was preoccupied with the function of another mysterious protein named PD-1. As with Allison, a decade went by yielding bizarre, often contradictory results. But Hanjo's team slowly converged on the function of PD-1. This protein, they found, was similar to CTLA-4 in that it, too, was a tolerizer. Like CTLA-4, PD-1 is expressed on T cells. Its cognate binder, effectively its off switch, is called PD-L1. It is present at low levels on the surface of some normal cells all over the body. If you imagine CTLA-4 on T cells as a safety switch on a gun, then PD-L1 on normal cells is an orange jacket worn by an innocent bystander that says, "Don't shoot! I'm harmless!" In fact, PD-L1 is more than an orange safety jacket. It even induces T cell death, thereby completely disabling a T cell attack. In a matter of decades, two new systems of peripheral tolerance had been discovered and potentially inactivated. The binding of CTLA-4 on T cells makes them impotent. The presence of PD-L1 on normal cells makes them invisible. Somewhere in the combination of impotence and invisibility lie the twin mechanisms that prevent the body from swallowing itself. Cancers, we now know, can use both these mechanisms to cloak themselves against immune attack. Some express PD-L1, in essence, stitching their own orange jackets of invisibility. "Don't shoot, I'm harmless." When PD-1 inhibitors were injected into mice, Hanjo found, T cells were incited to attack even orange-jacketed immune-resistant tumors. The cancer's bluff was called. Both Hanjo and Allison had independently converged on the same paradigm. Turn off the safety locks on a T cell, or strip away the orange jackets of the cancer cells, and the immune response could actually turn against cancer. They had checkmated the checkpoints. A new class of drugs grew out of this work, antibodies to inhibit CTLA-4 and PD-1 among them. The first clinical trials with these new drugs revealed their potency. Melanomas resistant to chemotherapies regressed and disappeared. Metastatic bladder tumors were attacked and rejected. Why? How? Why can a cancer cell circumvent T cells designed to recognize and kill it? This question haunts immunotherapy today. Something about a solid tumor, perhaps the environment that it has created around itself, can circumvent and inhibit even the most potent reactivation of T cells. What is that something? The most solid evidence, and this is not a play on words, is that the immune attack on a cancer can occur only if a fully active lymphoid organ containing neutrophils, macrophages, helper T cells, killer T cells, and an organized cellular structure can be formed within a solid tumor. This secondary lymphoid organ, SLO, is like a lymph node that is usually formed when T cells attack a virus or a pathogen. except in this case, it is organized against a tumor. Tumors that do not enable the formation of such SLOs are resistant to immunotherapy, while those that do form them are generally sensitive. But that's a correlation. The cause and effect relationships and the mechanisms that enable or disable the formation of such SLOs have yet to be uncovered. Once we understand them, a new generation of immunotherapeutic drugs or combinations can be unleashed on cancer cells. A novel form of immunotherapy for cancer, termed checkpoint inhibition, the removal of tolerizing checks on T cells, was born. Yet, these therapies had their limitations. Take off the trigger locks, and the activated T cells, eager to attack, might turn on normal cells. It was this autoimmune attack on his own liver cells that ultimately limited my friend Sam P.'s response to treatment. Checkpoint inhibitors did unleash T cells against his melanoma, bringing its malignant growth under control, but they also unleashed an assault on his liver that we could never overcome. It was a medically induced form of horror autotoxicus. He was caught on the border between his cancer and himself. Eventually, the tumor cells circumvented the border and survived. Sam was left behind. I finished this part of the book, coincidentally, on a Monday morning, the day I reserved to look at blood. I left the office, where I usually write, and walked down the corridor to the microscope room, empty and silent, thankfully. The lights went down, the scope flickered on. A box of glass slides was waiting on the table. I mounted one on the scope and turned the focusing knob. Blood, a cosmos of cells. The restless ones, red blood cells. The guardians, multi-lobed neutrophils that mount the first phases of the immune response. The healers, tiny platelets, once dismissed as fragmentary nonsense, that redefined how we respond to breaches in the body. The defenders, the discerners, B cells that make antibody missiles, T cells, door-to-door wanderers that can detect even the whiff of an invader, including, possibly, cancer. As my eyes darted from one cell to another, I thought about the trajectory of this book. Our story has moved, our vocabulary has shifted, our metaphors have changed. Go back a few chapters and we imagine the cell as a lone spaceship. Then, in the chapter The Dividing Cell, the cell was no longer single but became the progenitors of two cells, and then four. It was a founder, the originator of tissues, organs, bodies, fulfilling the dream of one cell becoming two and four, and then it transformed into a colony, the developing embryo with cells settling and positioning themselves within the landscape of an organism. And blood? It is a conglomerate of organs, a system of systems. It has built training camps for its armies, lymph nodes, highways and alleys to move its cells, blood vessels. It has citadels and walls that are constantly being surveyed and repaired by its residents, neutrophils and platelets. It has invented a system of identification cards to recognize its citizens and eject intruders, T cells, and an army to guard itself from invaders, B cells. It has evolved language, organization, memory, architecture, subcultures, and self-recognition. A new metaphor comes to mind. Perhaps we might think of it as a cellular civilization.